From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a great film director who is said to be as obsessive as some of his characters. We talk with Werner Herzog, one of the leading German directors to emerge after Hitler and World War II destroyed the country's film industry. Herzog's films include Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, and Nosferatu. Cinemax is about to show his documentary about a U.S. pilot shot down during the Vietnam War who managed to escape from a prison camp in Laos. And rock historian Ed Ward begins his series on how black and white country musical traditions influenced each other early in the century. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Hurricane Mitch is swirling off the coast of Honduras. Maximum winds 165 miles per hour. The storm is now not expected to crash across Honduras. Instead, it's headed for Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Michael Formosa is a forecaster with the National Hurricane Center in Miami. He explains the situation for Honduras.
They're being spared right now because the storm is, 90 miles to the north of the coast of Honduras, okay? And yesterday, one of the Honduran islands got hit, Swan Island. You know, the eye went right over the island. And the storm is moving west and eventually be moving northwest away from Honduras.
Belize and Guatemala are under hurricane warning. The White House says Yugoslav forces are complying with NATO demands to pull out of Kosovo to avert airstrikes. NATO ambassadors are meeting in Brussels to review the situation. NPR's Edward Lifson reports from Belgrade.
At least 4,000 Serb special police were seen leaving their positions around Kosovo today to head back to their barracks or even out of Kosovo, where they've been stationed since fighting began 8 months ago, between Milosevic's forces and ethnic Albanians who want to separate Kosovo from Serbia. It is not clear whether the Serbs will have withdrawn enough of their forces by tonight's deadline to reach the level they agreed to in negotiations with U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke 2 weeks ago. But Western diplomats are reporting a new agreement with Milosevic, agreed to last Sunday in Belgrade, in which he will remove a certain number of his special police and army troops each week. As the Serb special police leave Kosovo, they're burning some buildings behind them, and humanitarian groups warn the Albanian refugees returning home to watch out for landmines that may have been recently planted. Edward Lifson, NPR News, Belgrade.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has been moved to a medical center after canceling a trip to Austria for health reasons. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin today was back at the Barvikha Medical Center, the same place where he recovered from heart surgery 2 years ago and where he spent several weeks late last year getting over a viral infection. Kremlin officials say he's there now to recover from severe exhaustion. Yesterday, officials said his blood pressure is unstable and he's weak both physically and emotionally. Doctors told him he needs a vacation and ordered him to call off his trip to Austria, which had been scheduled for today. He also cut short a trip to Central Asia earlier this month when he came down with bronchitis. Kremlin officials have repeatedly played down health concerns, but Yeltsin's hospitalization today is sure to provoke more calls from the opposition that he stepped down as president. He has said he plans to fulfill his term, which ends in 2000. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 7.5 points at 84.24. The NASDAQ is up 17. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a rise in small company shares plus renewed optimism from investors in technology stocks are giving the stock market an early boost today. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Though Wall Street is off its earlier highs of the session, at one point the Dow was up 100 points this morning, one factor helping to power the market higher. Gains in the technology companies, IBM, Dell, and Compaq, were all higher today. That comes at a time investors are deciding that high-tech stocks are more reasonably priced than they've been in some time. IBM's board also announced a $3.5 billion stock buyback today. A negative note for the market came in the form of the latest consumer confidence figures, however. The conference board reported today that for October, its confidence index fell 9 points, its biggest drop in 2 years, and its fourth straight monthly decline. The data measures how consumers view the economy for the next 6 months. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
Russian officials say they will likely export a record amount of crude oil this year, despite promising to cut back on oil sales to stop the slide in world oil prices. Russian officials say their country does not really have any other source of cash. But because world oil prices are so low right now, about $14 per barrel, Russia probably won't see much of a huge revenue increase. Germany's new prime minister, Gerhard Schröder, has taken the oath of office. He's promised to dedicate his office to the welfare of German people. Schröder's party, the Social Democrats, have worked out an alliance with the environmentalist Green Party. The number one issue for Germans is unemployment. 4 million Germans are out of work. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials down 7.5 at 84.24. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Werner Herzog, is one of the directors who reestablished Germany as a major force in cinema after its movie industry was decimated by Hitler and World War II. Herzog was born in 1942. Many of his movies have been about physical and emotional extremes. Land of Silence and Darkness is about people who are deaf and blind. Even Dwarves Started Small is about dwarves in a correctional institution. Aguirre, the Wrath of God is about a mad Spanish conquistador. Fitzcarraldo follows a man obsessed with building an opera house in the jungle. Herzog's Nosferatu is perhaps the most beautiful and disturbing film of the Dracula story. Herzog's recent documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, premieres on Cinemax Thursday evening. It's the story of Dieter Dengler, a German-born U.S. pilot who was shot down during the war in Vietnam, then imprisoned and tortured in Laos. He managed to escape against incredible odds. Here he is describing the day he escaped.
I ran out in the open. Nobody came from this side except the guards. They're running in my direction. They must have heard or seen the other guys. And this big shootout started. All of a sudden, the bullets were flying. Somehow, we had miscalculated. Somebody had a rifle in there. I had this submachine gun in my hand. I'd never shot one before. When I pulled the trigger, it practically flew out of my hand. It raised up like that, and this allowed them to close this distance real quick. They came within 2 or 3 feet for me. The moron, one of the guys, had a machete in his hand. He came within 4 or 5 feet. I shot him through the hip. It lifted him up. It threw him down to the ground. Next thing I'm looking up, he's getting up again. He still had the machete. He's still coming at me. Of course, this time I couldn't miss. He was right 2 or 3 feet in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I didn't have a scratch. There's 5 dead guards laying on the ground. 2 of them got away. They ran a zigzag pattern. They got in the jungle. I knew then, right then and there, they would get help, and we had to get out of there. Where was Dwayne? I saw him behind this bush over here. He had vomited. I yelled to him, Dwayne, let's get out here. Let's get out of here. We took off. We ran down between this kitchen. We ran amongst those dead guys laying on the ground. And it was very important because our shoes were tied together in a bundle. We're hanging on this hut over here. The shoes we needed in the jungle, but when we got there, they were already taken. The other guys must have taken them, run off with them. And then Dwayne and I, we had no choice but to turn around. Barefoot, we ran into the jungle. Out of the 7 of us that escaped, I was the only one that came out alive. The other one disappeared in the jungle, and nobody ever heard from them again.
Dieter Dengler's escape was filled with hellish adventures, including surviving a monsoon without any protection. I asked film director Werner Herzog how he thought Dieter Dengler was changed by all that he experienced in prison and during his escape.
I do believe that he was not very much changed because he had a very difficult and hard childhood, and that somehow linked me together with him immediately. Both of us grew up in tiny rural villages in rural areas, remote from everything. We didn't know what TV was, what a telephone was. I made my first phone call at the age of 17. And he knew hunger, and he knew all the hardships of growing up as a post-war child. And I do believe that he was extremely well prepared, better than anyone else that I would know for an ordeal of that nature. He had all the qualities that make America so wonderful, the qualities of self-reliance, courage, spirit of some sort of a frontier, and all those things.
You brought him back to the jungle and had him simulate some of the scenes that he lived through when he was in the prison camp. It seems like it was almost masochistic on his part to agree to that.
Not really, because he felt very much at ease with this whole thing. Fact is that he has been at least 15 times before we made the film back to the jungle, back to Southeast Asia. He loves Asian people. He loves the qualities, the human qualities of his former enemies. And that may be the only change, to come back to the previous question. He changed his attitude about the opponent, about the enemy, the Vietnamese, the Laotians. He had no concept of who they were. I mean, he started in the war very, very early in 1965, where nobody really talked about Vietnam, and he thought it would be over in 3 weeks, that they just had to assist some South Vietnamese generals to stop a few insurgents from the north. And in his first mission over North Vietnam, he was actually shot down after 40 minutes. So he didn't really capture what the war was all about. Once he was down on the ground, the entire country was not an abstract grid on a map anymore. It was, all of a sudden, it was filled with voices, with human beings, with people who were starving, people who were under pressure of air attacks and all this. And almost immediately he started to change his attitude, to understand that there were real people down there, real suffering down there, real death down there.
He seems to be very obsessive in his descriptions of the past, obsessed with what is required to survive. And he's almost a survivalist now. I mean, you have him saying that he keeps hundreds of pounds of grains in his house in case of emergency because he knows what it's like to be without food. And watching the movie, I kept wondering, was this guy really obsessive before his imprisonment, or did he become obsessive as a result of his imprisonment? And I know that you are very interested in obsession and are probably pretty obsessive yourself. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
I wouldn't really call him obsessive.
No.
Of course, he has been changed by all these experiences, and he feels much safer to have 1,100 pounds of rice and 1,000 pounds of flour under his kitchen floor dug into the ground. Sure, that is understandable. And he has developed certain safeguards. He's a very wholesome man, a very healthy human being. Sometimes I have the feeling he's hiding his wounds, and he's hiding the terror behind some very casual remarks. I would, for example, ask him in private, "Dieter, don't you have any nightmares of that time? Is there nothing left?" And he says, "Oh, that was the fun part of my life." So we can only sense that there's still some open wounds within the man, but he's not collapsing and not struggling for his sanity and all those things that you might have seen among many of the Vietnam veterans who came home and who were innerly destroyed.
How come you've been making so many documentaries? I know you've made documentaries on and off through your career, but it seems to be, well, exclusively what you're doing now.
It's not the exclusive thing I'm doing now. Once in a while, I stage operas. I love to live and breathe and work with music. But it is true, in the last couple of years, I've only done documentaries. And that was a development, a deep question about filmmaking, probably about writing or art in general. What constitutes truth in, for example, a great poem? When you read Robert Frost and you have some very deep feeling about it, and all of a sudden you have this sensation there is some deep, inexplicable and mysterious truth in it. And the same thing happens in movies. And it does not happen, strangely enough, in the most of the documentaries that you would see on television. You would not find it in the so-called cinema vérité, which can only scratch the surface of what is truth. It's the accountant's truth. It's the bookkeeper's truth. And yet, I have been for years after the question, how can you dig into a very deep stratum of truth, into something inexplicable, something mysterious. And of course, you can reach it and you can find it, but normally through invention, through imagination, through fabrication, sometimes even contorting and stylizing events right out there. And then all of a sudden, you will find something strange and deep and elusive, and that is a certain truth. Now, with all this knowledge that I have now, I'm moving actually back to feature filmmaking.
What's your next film going to be?
Well, I'm working on a film right now, which again is a documentary, but highly stylized. And you must not make the mistake to believe that everything in Little Dieter Needs to Fly is the accountant's truth. Much of it has been invented. And so my very next film is very inventive as well. In going back to Dieter's film, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, his dreams are my invention. Or, for example, there's a scene where he tries to explain how death looks like for him. And he's standing in front of a tank with jellyfish in it, a water tank. And he simply tried to explain it to me, what death was looking like for him. And he had no image. And he described it in a way that I immediately figured it was jellyfish slowly moving, almost dancing in a void, and in a slow motion, transparent, strange movement. And that was exactly what was needed. He only couldn't express it, but I had the image for it.
My guest is director Werner Herzog. His documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, premieres Thursday evening on Cinemax. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is German film director Werner Herzog. Now, I believe you're making a documentary on Klaus Kinski. Klaus Kinski starred in at least four of your films, and those films include Aguirre,
five,
The Wrath of God,
actually, yeah.
God Fitzcarraldo, Nosferatu.
Wojtek,
right.
Yes, and Cobra Verde. So it's five feature films that I made. I have survived them all.
Well, yeah, no, I mean in the films that he's in of yours that I've seen, he always plays madmen of one sort or another. And I'm wondering if you felt that he had a touch of madness in him that made him especially gifted for those roles.
Yeah, certainly. There was a high amount of hysteria inside this man. There was a blurred borderline between sanity and paranoia. I mean, the man was totally over the cliff sometimes. He was the most difficult one in the world. I think that a man like Marlon Brando was only kindergarten against him. So Kinski was sometimes the ultimate pestilence, and all the other actors and the crew would say, "Oh my God, how can you do this again to me, to us, to engage him again?" And I said, "Forget about all the hardships with him. He's somehow blessed. He has some touch of genius. There is something which makes it all worthwhile to go through it." But at the same time, I have to say, we had a very deep understanding for each other. We had friendship for each other. We had a rapport, an understanding which sometimes was not even verbal, but something that does not happen very often between an actor and a director. And those moments were moments where we achieved a lot and unforgettable images and unforgettable moments.
Let me ask you about your film, A Gare, the Wrath of God, from the early 70s, which Klaus Kinski starred in as the head of a Spanish expedition to Peru. And he becomes a madman, and he keeps pushing his men forward in this expedition, forward into crossing mountains and fording rivers that they can't possibly survive. And he just becomes more and more obsessed and mad as the expedition becomes more and more dangerous and more people die. What did you tell Kinski about the character?
I do believe that Kinski understood the character instantly once he read the screenplay.
This is set in like 1560. I don't think I mentioned that.
Yes, it's Spanish conquistadors in search of El Dorado, and an entire army disappears without a trace in the jungle. So that's basically the story. And a madman, Kinski, grasps power and grabs power and leads everyone into inevitable death.
So you were saying what you told him about the role.
He read the screenplay, and 3 days later, I had a call at 3 a.m. It lasted until 4, and I could not understand who was on the line because there were these inarticulate screams for half an hour, and I had the feeling I should stay on the phone, and I realized it was Kinski. And he kept screaming, then it became a little bit more articulate that this was the figure he always wanted to play. This was the role for him. And I had the feeling the man had understood exactly what it was all about. He had not understood indeed what hardship it would be to make that film, because we only had $360,000 to make this entire film, which is a $40 million project if you look at it. And he had never been into the jungle. He had just not known what was expecting him.
The last line he speaks in the film, after he's gone completely mad and everybody is basically dead, he says, "We will endure. I am Aguirre, the wrath of God. Who else is with me?" How did you come up with that last line, and what does it mean to you?
Well, you have to know the situation. He's on a raft with dying and dead Spaniards floating down into some void of the Amazon basin, and hundreds of little monkeys have invaded the raft. And they swarm all around him, and he grabs a monkey and he talks to the monkey, and he, mad as he is, he is planning to found the purest dynasty on earth with his own daughter, who is actually dying. And he talks to a monkey and he says, "I'm the wrath, I'm Aguirre, I'm the wrath of God. Who else is with me?" And then tosses the monkey away. So it is a great metaphor for, and I can't even tell you for what, I can't even name it. But I know there's a great metaphor in the end.
There's a wonderful camera shot. You know, you described this last scene here in which Kinski's, you know, saying, "I am Aguirre, the wrath of God." And everyone, the raft that he's on is just in complete shambles. And all the remaining people are either dying or they're already dead. And as you said, you know, the monkeys have invaded the raft and they're all over. And the camera first kind of like zooms across the river to the raft and then circles around the raft in this slow but still kind of dizzying shot. Would you talk to me about that shot? It's really a magnificent shot. It's the shot that closes the movie.
Yeah, it's the most simple thing you can do. Everybody thought it was a very complicated type of helicopter shot. It was actually a regular speedboat, and I maneuvered it myself because I have a very good sense in my body how fast the camera should approach and then circle around the raft. The only problem is that when you slow your boat down, coming from such a speed, you create a huge wake which overtakes you. And you have to look behind you and see what is happening. And so I kept looking at the camera, and I kept looking at the wake behind me, and I hardly could see the raft. I almost collided a couple of times with it, and I kept circling around it until we actually collided, but by then the film in the camera had run out.
Huh. Now, in that shot, Klaus Kinski, he's standing up. Everybody else is lying down because they're all dead or dying. And he's tilted to one side. I mean, he's not standing straight. He's all the way tilted at an angle, which just kind of emphasizes the madness that has overtaken him.
Yeah.
Was that his idea, your idea, to have that tilt?
It's not only in the last scene. I had the feeling that Aguirre should be somehow deformed, a little bit disfigured. We thought about a hump on his back, a vicious little hump like a little piece of cancer, like a little fist in his neck. But then we made a little hump on his chest, like a chicken chest. And I wanted him to walk like a crab a little bit sideways, a little bit spidery, a little bit eerie in his kind of movement. And I think he did it very, very well. And it is not only the final scene. You will see it throughout the movie. And the more the film closes down to its final scenes, the more it becomes visible.
There's such intensity on Kinski's face in the film. And I'm wondering how he prepared for the role, what advice you gave him for that role, and how he prepared for it to capture the madness, the obsession.
There is no rule for that. I'm not into this kind of method acting like Lee Strasberg's studio. I just loathe these kind of endless talks about a character. It went in a different way. Sometimes, for example, when Aguirre turns mad and he declares to his men that he was the wrath of God, and he threatens them and says, everyone who or whoever just takes one grain of corn too much will be imprisoned for 155 years. And he says, if I, Aguirre, want the birds to drop dead from the trees, the birds will drop dead from the trees. So we had the text. Kinski wanted to play it to scream and throw a tantrum and have a fit of insanity. And I had the feeling it would be much, much better to have it at very low level, totally reduced, totally dangerous, almost in whispers. So I provoked Kinski with a very nasty remark, and Kinski started to scream and throw a tantrum. So he kept screaming for 1.5 hours until there was froth at his mouth. And then he had exhausted himself. He was kind of finished and destroyed. And then I said, roll the camera. And I said, Klaus, this is wonderful now. Let's try it and keep it very, very low in voice. Do it. And he did it, and he did it once, and that was it. And it's one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen on a screen.
Werner Herzog will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, director Werner Herzog tells us why he threatened to shoot actor Klaus Kinski while they were filming Aguirre, The Wrath of God. And rock historian Ed Ward begins a series on how black and white music traditions influenced early country music.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Werner Herzog, one of the film directors who remade the German cinema after it was destroyed by World War II. His documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, premieres Thursday evening on Cinemax. Many of Herzog's films are about physical extremes and extreme states of mind. Herzog is considered to be an obsessive filmmaker. The late Klaus Kinski, who starred in Herzog's films Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, and Nosferatu, was known for his volatility and paranoia. Now, you made two films that I know of with Kinski in the jungle, Aguirre and Fitzcarraldo. Did you get along well in the jungle together? I mean, I imagine that making a film in the jungle... I know that making a film in the jungle is exceptionally difficult, and I know Fitzcarraldo had many, many difficulties that you had to overcome. But what did that do to your relationship with Kinski?
Well, it was our very first relationship, even though by coincidence I lived in the same apartment with him for 3 months when I was 13. And I met him there as a totally mad person who would destroy the whole apartment in a whim or whatever. So I knew what expected me. And of course, there were moments of great harmony, and there were moments of unbelievable confrontations. And one of the worst was, for no reason whatsoever, Kinski threatened to leave the set 11 days before the end of shooting.
Which film was this?
I'm speaking of Aguirre, The Wrath of God. Mm-hmm. So my first film together with him. And he packed all his things into a speedboat and he was just about to leave. Of course, that would have destroyed the entire film. And I told him that I had made up my mind months ago what would be the borderline of what could be acceptable and not. And of course, the film, in my opinion, had more value than his or my private feelings and disgust or whatever. And I said to him, if you leave the set now, you will reach the next bend of the river and I will shoot you. You will have 8 bullets through your head and the last one is going to be for me. So the bastard somehow realized that this was not a joke anymore. It wouldn't have taken me 1 second to deliberate. And he sensed that, and he screamed for help. He screamed for the crew to help him, assist him against this madman, and he meant me. And he screamed for police, but of course the next police station was 450 miles away. Result was that he was very docile during the last 11 days of shooting, and we finished the film.
You really think you would have shot him?
If I try to put myself into the situation, and that was back in 1972, beginning of 72, so 27 years ago, yes, I think so.
Was he angry with you? Did he think you were pushing him too hard for the movie?
No. It was just somehow he had forgotten his lines and he always would look for an excuse and he screamed that an assistant sound man had grinned at him and I had to dismiss him on the spot. And I said, no, number one, he didn't grin. And even if he had grinned, we just repeat that thing and we take him out of your line of eyesight. That's all right. And I cannot, and he ultimately demanded me to dismiss him right on the spot. And of course, the entire crew would have walked out of the film if I had done such an injustice. It was his fault. It was his mistake. He just did not, was unprepared and didn't know his lines anymore. In the moment he stopped, he would find some sort of an opponent or some reason why he had stumbled.
So it was basically a really large temper tantrum.
It was more than that. It was very close to insanity.
Oh, okay, yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Werner Herzog, and his documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly premieres October 29th on Cinemax. I want to ask you about another film that you made with Klaus Kinski, and that's Nosferatu. And I'm glad to say you just told me that this film will be re-released probably at the beginning of 1999, which is very exciting because it's a terrific film. And I love this version of the vampire story. Instead of the kind of dapper count that most Americans are familiar with through Bela Lugosi, he's a very rat-like ghoul, but one who seems very pained by his sentence of interminable life and pained by the fact that he has to drink people's blood. But it's inevitable. He must. He has to. And he does it. Would you talk a little bit about your vision of Nosferatu?
Well, my Nosferatu is based on the greatest German film ever, in my opinion at least, Murnau's silent classic Nosferatu, which Murnau did in 1924. And as a German filmmaker after the war, we grew up as, not only me, but all my peers, we grew up as a fatherless generation, as a generation of orphans. Our fathers either had fled the country, were chased out, or they had sided with the barbarism of the Nazi regime. So we had no one to learn from, and we started to look out for our grandfathers, and that was Murnau or Fritz Lang and others. So I just needed to connect myself with a culture, with a legitimate great culture of Germany, and that was the culture of the grandfathers, or even earlier than that. So I made this film, but of course it's an homage to Murnau, and has been very important for me to do that film. And I'm glad that the rights are back to me now. 20th Century Fox has distributed the film worldwide, but in the last 10 years or so, they didn't really do anything about the film. And there will be a very fine DVD edition, for example, with the English and the German version parallel on the same laser disc, and some personally annotated comments and photos and other things. And I'm really looking forward to see this film back to life.
My guest is film director Werner Herzog. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Werner Herzog, and his films include Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, Wojciech. His Nosferatu is about to be re-released, and his latest documentary, Little Dieter Needs to Fly, premieres October 29th on Cinemax. You were born in 1942 and grew up in Germany in the very end of the war and in the post-war period. I'm wondering what your early memories are of the war or the post-war period.
I do have clear memories of that time. You have to imagine that when I was born in Munich, only 2 weeks later, a bomb hit the house next to us, and our place was half destroyed, and my mother discovered me, the baby, under a foot of shards of glass and debris. But I was unhurt, but my mother fled to the remotest mountain valley in Bavaria, and we got stuck there. So by the age of 11, I had no idea what a telephone was. I had never seen movies. I had never seen a TV set. I barely had seen cars in my life. And you may not believe this, but I made my first phone call at the age of 17. But I made my first movie at the age of 19. So that explains a little bit about the background. And of course, I remember the hardships, and I remember that I was hungry as a child and we had nothing to eat and things like this, which was quite all right because I had a wonderful childhood, and I wouldn't like to miss that.
You are very interested as a filmmaker in unusual and sometimes surrealistic kind of landscapes. And extreme landscapes, whether it's, you know, it's the jungle or the desert or a bombed out area. And I'm wondering if you had a lot of visual images like that kind of imprinted in you in the post-war era when Germany was so bombed out.
No, I belong to those Germans who didn't have a childhood image of the post-war Germany, because in this mountain village there was no real warfare. It was just occupied by 60 Americans at the very, very end of the war. It was the last pocket of unoccupied territory when Germany shrank more and more and more. All of a sudden, this was the last remaining unoccupied square mile or whatever. And 60 Americans moved in jeeps, and they were totally relaxed, chewing gum. And I had the feeling this was all the Americans of the world. And for the first time, I saw a black man. And I was totally mesmerized by seeing him because I had only heard about black people in fairy tales. And I immediately became friends with him and talked to him for hours. So what I want to say is the climate was not the climate of total destruction that Germany had witnessed all around me. It was a mountain village, a mountain valley, remote and just nature around. And only when I was 11 and the war was well over, I saw destroyed cities and bombed out places. And I developed a concept of what must have happened.
And were you frightened by that concept?
No, not really. It's strange because everybody thinks that German children who grew up in the post-war time had a terrible childhood. In the contrary, nobody was frightened. All my school friends who grew up in the cities, they are delirious about speaking of this time when they grew up in ruins and it was pure anarchy in the best sense of the word. There were no fathers around to tell them what to do and how to do things. They would be the masters and the kings of, let's say, a whole block that was bombed out. And they would, it was the most wonderful playground for children. Or for example, in my case, in this last days of war, some soldiers had fled into this area and had hidden their weapons under the hay or in the forest. And by age 4, age 5, I had a working submachine gun and fired with it. And I tried to hunt a crow because I wanted to make a soup. I was so hungry. And my mother discovered that, and she was totally calm and explained to us how lethal a weapon like that could be by just demonstrating it, by shooting one single round through a thick log of beech wood. And we were so stunned by the violence and force of such a weapon that we immediately had a clear sense how to behave. And it was just learning by experience. And the childhood of practically all the children who grew up in the post-war time was wonderful, as strange and as paradoxical as it may sound.
Now, you did have a father, I believe, and I think you've described him as someone who was a militant atheist, and at 14, you converted to Catholicism. Was that like in reaction against your father?
I do not believe so, because I grew up without the presence of my father.
Oh, I see.
In other words, my father was away in the war, and then he was prisoner of war, and came back a year and a half later, and then almost immediately divorced my mother. So I grew up without his presence. I wouldn't say it was a move against an overwhelming father figure. He was simply not there. But at the age of 14, there was a time of extremely lucid moments that I had. I had a very intensive religious urge, and I started to travel on foot. I walked all around the country Albania, always following its borderline. That's exactly Kosovo, where there's all this turmoil right now. But I was only 14 and a child. And at that time, I knew and I decided that my destiny inevitably was to be a poet or be the one who had to make the images, who had to make the films. And I shouldered all this very, very clearly, knowing that it would not be an easy life.
Now, I've read about this walk around Albania when you were a teenager, and I can't say I really understand what motivated you to do something so both extreme and in some ways pointless.
No, it was not pointless, certainly not at that time. And whenever I have traveled on foot, and I've traveled very, very large distances, mm-hmm. It always would have a very intensive, essential reason in my life.
Well, what was the reason with Albania?
It was a deep mystery. There was, in the middle of Europe, a white dot on the map, a country that was totally inaccessible. It was like Tibet in the 50s or 40s, where nobody was allowed to go in. Visas were denied to everyone. And also some sort of a heritage. My mother's family comes from the Balkans. They were actually Croatians. So there were deep reasons behind all these things. I can give you an example which is easier to understand. When I wanted to marry and have children, I could have done it over the phone to propose, or I could have written a letter and propose, or I could have taken a car. But I had the feeling a real man walks to his woman and proposes and asks the questions. And so I crossed the Alps and I walked about 1,000 miles and knocked at the door of my future wife. And in this case, I actually told her that I had come on foot because I had one question to ask. So I asked it. And I think that was the right way to do it. So there was a very existential reason for it.
Film director Werner Herzog is my guest, and his documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly is showing now on Cinemax. You've made films about people who are blind and deaf, films about dwarves, films about extreme environments, two films set in the jungle, lots of films about people who have gone mad and are very obsessive. And I wonder if you think that interest in extremes comes from a part of your personality that is willed, or just something that is just a part of you. And you know what I mean? If it is just this like natural understanding and gravitation mm-hmm. to extremes.
Well, apparently it must be some part of me. I think there's it. You observe it right that there is something personal about it. Even though I'm very cautious to look too intensively at myself, you may not believe this, but until this very day, I do not even know the color of my eyes. I do look into mirrors every single morning when I shave, but I'm looking at how I'm shaving and whether I do it right, but I would not look into my eyes. I don't want to take a close look.
Why not?
I don't know. I think it's a safety precaution. In other words, I'd rather die. I'd rather jump from the Golden Gate Bridge before I would go to an analyst.
That's funny, because for someone who has such insight as a movie maker and who in a way studies states of mind, as a movie maker to be so opposed to analysts or to the kind of introspection that you're talking about? It seems almost paradoxical.
No, it is not paradoxical. It is the only healthy way to stay alive.
To study other people's madness and not look at the color of your own eyes.
No, you better. It's a hysteria here in America, in particular, to discover your inner self and talk about inner growth and all these stupid things. Once in a while, it is very sane. It's almost clinically sane to take a certain distance from yourself and to look at yourself with a certain caution and do not step too far. You see, what's wrong about the analysts is that, let me put it in a different way, when you rent an apartment and you illuminate it with neon light to its very last corner and you put light everywhere, the apartment becomes uninhabitable. And it's the same thing when you illuminate the inner structure of a human being too intensively. That's something which is against our destiny, which is against how we are created, and it does not do good to us. And it shouldn't be like that. Human beings become uninhabitable when you do that too intensively.
Werner Herzog, I'd love to talk more. We're out of time. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Werner Herzog, his documentary Little Dieter Needs to Fly debuts Thursday evening on Cinemax. It's about a U.S. pilot who was shot down during the Vietnam War, taken prisoner, and then escaped from the prison camp. Coming up, Ed Ward on black and white influences in country music. This is Fresh Air. Too often, the African-American and Scots-Irish folk traditions are seen as totally separate streams, which only came together when Elvis Presley joined them on a single record. In the first of a two-part series, rock historian Ed Ward shows that things were never that simple, and that black and white music were influencing each other even before Elvis's mother was born.
What kind of music is this we're hearing? The answer is fairly obvious. It's so-called old-timey music, the sort of country music which predated and gave birth to bluegrass and disappeared in the 1930s as more modern forms emerged. Now, what about this? Country blues, which originated in Mississippi around the turn of the century and gave birth to a whole genre of American music. But what you couldn't have guessed, because you can't see the musicians performing these tunes, is that the first group was made up of African Americans, and the guitar player on the second piece was Frank Hutchinson, who was white and from the coal mining country of West Virginia, where black and white miners lived together in shared poverty. These two may be extreme examples, but they illustrate a solid point. No matter what musical segregationists might say or wish, the line between so-called black and white musical traditions in America has always been very porous. What's really ironic is that the banjo, played here by a noted black Nashville street musician, Nathan Frazier, has become identified with white country music when the instrument's origins are indisputably West African. Played by whites initially as part of the minstrel show, in which they impersonated blacks, it was soon taken up enthusiastically by less showbiz-oriented types. Although it's equally indisputable that many of the fiddle tunes the banjo has come to accompany are of Celtic origin, every major banjo style, until Earl Scruggs introduced the three-finger roll style of picking in the 1940s, was a black innovation. So, of course, was the blues. But long before people looked at Eric Clapton or Johnny Winter and asked if white folks could play the blues, they were already doing it. Whites were enthusiastic purchasers of blues records from the beginning. The sales of Mamie Smith's 1921 Crazy Blues, the first record to use the word, can't be explained any other way. This paved the way for one of the first American superstars.
Standing on the corner, I didn't mean no harm. Along come a police, he took me by the arm. It was down in Memphis, corner of Beale and Main. He says, big boy, you'll have to tell me your name. Doodly-ay-o-dly.
Jimmy Rogers, it can be safely said, made his career playing blues. True, the sentimental tunes he recorded sold well too, but it's his blues numbers we hear in our heads when his name comes up. Just to confuse things further, his accompanists on Blue Yodel No. 9, which we just heard, are Louis and Lil Armstrong. And although it's hard to say just where Rogers' yodel came from, his records sold well enough that young Chester Burnett, who traveled with Robert Johnson, said he was inspired by it to create the whoop which gave him his stage name, Howlin' Wolf. Nor was Rogers the only country musician of the 1930s who mined the black tradition and shaped it to his own ends.
Corrine, Corrina, where you been so long? Tell me, Corrina, where you been so long? Ain't had no lovin' since you've been gone. Oh, Corrina.
Bob Wills, who picked cotton as a youth with black sharecroppers in West Texas, mixed the fiddle tunes he'd learned from his grandfather with ideas he heard on Count Basie and Fletcher Henderson records, and, with his band the Texas Playboys, laid the rules for the music which became known as Western Swing. Note that Corrine Corrina, an early hit of his, is a straightforward blues and comes directly from black sources. Everything we've heard so far was recorded before the radio became all pervasive and before radio played phonograph records. Once that happened, things really got mixed up.
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurek directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from HarperCollins, publisher of Barbara Kingsolver's new novel, The Poisonwood Bible, available in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.